Chapter 9, Three Keys. "See, isn't it nice over here in the shade of the trees?" remarked Dilly. "It sure beats meeting indoors. I wish we practiced out here all the time." "Why are we so lucky today?" asked Dodd. "Sir Long promised to show us some clever moves with trees and grass and rocks as terrain. After all, you won't always be indoors when dueling with an enemy." "I guess," admitted Dodd hesitantly. He thought about swordplay, and though it sounded very exciting, he didn't like the idea of ever dueling in a real battle. A crowd of nearly 50 treaders, mostly Koosings, Greenlings, and Rawlings, all gathered under gigantic trees, which lined the outer perimeter of the open field. Across the grass, Bombu's house stood a massive mountain of stone and glass. Trees and gardens in the outer patios and courtyards at different elevations gave the great castle a look that resembled a city on a hillside rather than one building. Its layers towered skyward, reaching heights of nearly 30 stories in the middle, yet it was well-proportioned and comely. "That's a big house," said Dodd to Dilly. He couldn't help being amazed at the sheer size, not to mention the unusual architecture. "Yes, it's the biggest I know of. I'm sure plenty of people are jealous of Bombu, but he has always used it for good purposes, and that's more than anyone could say of Tarot." Dodd thought for a moment, then remembered bits and pieces about Tarot. He currently reigned as the chief noble treader of Rawl. However, despite the fact that they technically had a democracy like Green, Tarot's leadership leaned increasingly in the direction of a dictatorship. "Tarot's house," Dilly added, "is the second largest, and by far the largest one in Rawl. Unfortunately, most of it sits empty unless he's entertaining dignitaries and nobles or rewarding senior officers in his army. That's about it for the Chantoli estate. I wish Saab would take his lot from Rawl and go home to live with his dad in their castle. They have plenty of space. A few years back, Bombu suggested they create an extension of Twistyard there, but Tarot insisted he wouldn't have young people pointlessly frolicking about his manor in support of a dying purpose. I find it nervy of him to send his son Saab and his brother Sir Lonk, along with so many others from Rawl, while separating his wealth from the cause." Dodd started to speak in agreement when Buck suddenly came up and put his hand over Dodd's mouth. "Sir Lonk's here. You had better both show him some respect." Buck then lowered his voice to a whisper. "I agree they're all arrogant, especially Tarot and Sir Lonk. Nobody from Green would dispute that." "Do you have something to share with us?" bellowed Sir Lonk in a condescending manner. Everyone jumped to attention and stared at Buck. "No, sir," answered Buck apologetically, standing respectfully stiff. "Good, then I shan't have you tittering with your friends. Pots meet elsewhere, along with the ill-mannered sorts like your brother Boot. You're welcome to join them." Buck cringed when Sir Lonk mentioned Boot. Dodd looked around and noticed that he was missing from the crowd. "Now then," continued Sir Lonk in a proud voice, "when you've fought as many battles as I have, you take swordplay very seriously. I don't waste my time on beginning levels of engagement. Others can trifle with that. You are the best at Twistyard, pathetic as you are, so as a favor to society, I'll continue to bear with you." Sir Lonk was unusually good-looking. He had the face and figure of a muscular movie star, with jet-black hair, dark piercing eyes, and olive skin. As he paced back and forth in front of the youth, Dodd noticed the precision of every step. He walked and talked as a noble treader, and was indeed the embodiment of royalty. Even the rude comments he made seemed justified when spoken from his lips. All 6'3" of Sir Lonk was adorned in the most costly apparel. A white three-piece suit, white shirt, white gloves, and white leather boots. The tips of his sleeves were closed by shiny gold buttons that matched the golden clasps on his boots, and each of the buttons had a fancy family insignia. "If you listen closely," Sir Lonk arrogantly insisted, "you will obtain three keys for me today. They are keys that will unlock the door to your escape." Two snudged up behind Dodd and courageously whispered in his ear when Sir Lonk was almost at the farthest point of his pacing route. "Take a look at those medals. With all of the white he wears, you think he wants to make sure everyone notices them." As Sir Lonk made his way back, Dodd quietly counted the 12 golden and ruby awards pinned across the front lapels of his outer coat. He waited for Sir Lonk to continue his prance back to the other side before whispering over his shoulder to Toos, "What are the medals for?" Dilly poked Dodd in the ribs with her elbow and gave him a cross look. "He's decorated for bravery," said Toos quietly. "He's completed hordes of successful missions. On some of them, he was the only survivor. Sir Lonk's a regular hero to Highgate, recovering bunches of triblots and stuff." Dodd nodded his head, remembering Dilly's torrent of stories about Sir Lonk, and in acknowledgement of hearing Toos, Unfortunately, the motion caught Sirlonk's attention and happened to coincide with the wrong segment of his lecture. Sirlonk had just asked a rhetorical question. Would you have dared to face 20 of Dredarius's men by yourself? By nodding, Dodd appeared to be dismissing Sirlonk's heroic experience as commonplace. You, blurted Sirlonk in a harsh voice. He pointed at Dodd. I don't believe you were ever invited to join us. You're nameless to me, and I can see you're a human, so that quickly rules you out as being anyone important. It's criminal to waste my time with your games. Leave now before you find yourself at the tip of my cold blade. The group was speechless, and many of them had a look of fear for Dodd. Except Sob and his group of Cousings and Rawlings, they appeared perfectly happy. Buck and Toos both sympathized with Dodd, but didn't dare say anything. The silence was smothering. Dodd could feel his face getting hot. He was terrified and furious at the same time. I invited him, sir, said Dilly in a respectful voice. After the tales I was told by your friends, Tritacello, Dungo, and Bowler, I assumed you knew of Dodd, or I would have requested permission to make a formal presentation of him. Dodd? Said Sirlonk. I don't recall ever hearing of Dodd. How old are you, boy? Dodd was flustered by the confrontation. It was difficult to get his mouth open enough to answer him. Dilly nudged again with her elbow and prodded Dodd to speak. I'm 14, he squeaked. Everyone started laughing. 14, said Sirlonk with a chuckle. You're hardly weaned. Where's your mother? I should expect she is worried stiff that you've escaped your crib. I suppose someone has loaned you as a youngling to keep Jim company, eh? Perhaps you've lost your way and you are looking to help Zerny and Jib in the stalls. Sirlonk walked up close to Dodd and breathed down on him. His glare was bone-chilling. Bombu has developed a terrible weak side to him, snorted Sirlonk bitterly. Inviting a 14-year-old to play in this dangerous place. Well, that's just laughable. Accidents happen, you know. He's too old to know what's proper anymore. Come on, Dodd, said Dilly loudly, clenching one fist until her knuckles went white. I guess I introduced you incorrectly. We'll wait till the banquet at Highgate and have Commendus do a better job when awarding you for the recovery of their recently stolen triblot. Besides, if Sirlonk is too busy to aid in the training of Pap's grandson, he must be really busy. It was unbelievable that Dilly dared say her part. She had attempted to be polite at first, yet she passed her limit when Sirlonk made fun of Bombu. Dilly grabbed Dodd by his shirt at the shoulder and whisked him away from the group. She pulled hard enough that Dodd actually smacked right into Sirlonk on the way out. Sirlonk's torso felt like a brick wall. See you at the tournaments, losers, yelled Sob. He had held his tongue up to that point. His buddies all seemed delighted that Dilly and Dodd were on their way out. Sirlonk didn't ask Dilly to return, but he focused his attention on scolding Sob and the others for not informing him that Dodd was Pap's grandson and a recipient of attention from Highgate. Dilly vented her mind while they crossed the field and walked the halls of the castle. Astonishingly, she appeared to be mad at Dodd, not Sirlonk. It was perplexing to Dodd until Dilly finally cooled off enough to explain. You haven't said much this whole time, which leads me to believe you think I'm wrong for being mad at you. Dodd gradually nodded his head in agreement, quietly listening. What you need to understand is that I plan on winning, and not just at the tournaments. If I can learn from a snake like Sirlonk to be better with a sword, I'm going to bite my tongue and leech his skills. He's a horse's tail, I know it. Don't you think I would love to have Bombu draw him out and send him on his way? Of course! Though that's too easy, then he wins. He'd take his sword skills and his stories of glory and leave me a worse pupil. Dilly came to a stop in front of two large doors and turned to look at Dodd. I've had my share of problems. It's hard to learn from him. However, he's still the best. And until someone else, some Humberone, comes along with better skills, I'm going to keep trying to glean from his swordplay. Dilly pushed one of the doors open and led Dodd up some stairs and into the back of a packed conference room. It was an amphitheater, so even the rear had a decent view. Most of the 400 people appeared to be Pots, with a few Cousings, Greenlings, Rawlings, and Sushlings in the mix. They all stared in anticipation at the front of the room. You could have heard a pin drop. Yuke stood quietly facing the audience with a long, slender stick in his hand. Smack! It happened in the blink of an eye. Yuke's rod hit the podium and he disappeared behind it. Only his white hat with the large feather on top remained visible. Everyone gasped with delight. Apparently he was demonstrating something he had just discussed. Dilly poked a young pot and asked her what he was doing. "He's talking about trickery," she responded, craning her head to see over the spiky hair of a taller boy. "He said our best tool to mislead an enemy is the art of surprise, using their expectations against them." Just then, an obnoxiously boisterous lad at the front yelled, "I think we get the point, Yuke. Come on out. You're not hiding very well. We can still see the top of your hat." "Then you've only got my hat," rumbled someone from the back of the room, right behind Dodd. Everyone turned in amazement. Dodd was startled nearly out of his seat. The man's voice was powerful, more so than his appearance would have suggested. He had successfully sneaked up on Dodd unawares and used masterful deception to do it. "Never assume what you see," he continued as he made his way to the stairs. "Always question the unusual, but be particularly skeptical of the apparent. Your opponent, if he or she is witty, will capitalize on the obvious to ensnare you. Don't fall for it." The rest of the discussion entailed maps and stories of strategies he had employed to beat armies and others he had utilized to entirely avoid war altogether. It was fascinating. Yuke was friendly and inviting. His accounts were told well enough that the whole group was patient to the end, and many of them begged for more when the session was over. Dilly insisted on introducing Dodd to Yuke, so they waited for people to leave the room and then made their way down. He was busily compiling his maps and securing his papers in a case. "That was great, as usual," said Dilly. "Thank you." "Oh, you're kind, my dear. You should be thanking your grandfather, not me. He's the one who taught me most of what I know. I was once a Kusing for a while, when I was your age. Those days are still some of my best memories. I'm just glad Bamboo has let me come back to this place, despite everything, you know. He's a generous man." "This is my friend Dodd," announced Dilly. "Nice to meet you," said Yuke with the tip of his hat. He drew his hand down and noticed his white glove. It had a black smudge across the back. "I hate it when I soil my slips," he said irritably. "It seems like I can't keep a pair clean anymore. I'm ready to give up on fancy dressing." Yuke wore nice clothes. He was built like a 6-foot beam pole, though the formal silk shirt and ruffled pants helped him look more natural. His attire portrayed a refined yet creative individual. "Don't stop," answered Dilly. "We would all be disappointed if you shed your suave style and dress. Besides, tell me so Lucy would allow it, and I wouldn't believe you. How is she these days?" "She's fine. Pushes me to do more and then insists I'm spending too much time going about. If she could make up her mind, I'd be able to keep her perfectly happy." "You must have known that would be the case," added Dilly. "Marrying into her family would have to be like signing up for a lifetime of impossible goals. Nothing seems to be enough for the Zoots." "How right you are. If I didn't love her so much, my aspirations would be a lot simpler. As it is, I'm constantly reminded at every family gathering of the nobility in their blood, all the way back to Dosontras. Some in the lot are even crazy enough to wish the world would revert to the way it was. The last thing I would ever fancy is to erase the technology and civility we've gained over the past 3,000 years and trade it in for ruling all of Green. Who in their right mind would honestly want to be a dictator anyway?" "Just about anyone from Rawl," snapped Dilly. She was still worked up from her encounter with Sir Lonk, and it showed on her face. "I don't even think your pals from Rawl would have liked it. Back then, ruling was another way of saying that you spent your life with the soldiers, killing and being killed. It was a real bloody mess. Besides, trying to preside over part of Green today would be a nightmare, let alone the whole thing. I'm doing well to manage my own life and occasionally give advice to my kids. It's a good thing we have democracy, and even then I feel for political leaders like Bamboo and Commendus." "Bah, I think you're being humble," insisted Dilly. She nudged him on the shoulder with her fist. "You'd make a great chief noble treader of Green. After all, you have come up with a lot of grand strategies to help keep the peace. You're right in line to be chosen when Gramps is gone. And make sure you tell Seleucia I said so." "Oh, I will," said Yuke, hurrying out the door. "Sorry I've got to run." Dilly and Dodd followed behind and both reached for the handle, yet neither got a chance to use it. Before they could, Yuke returned, swinging the door wide open. He looked right at Dilly. "Have you heard from Ducci? Any word from Rawl?" Yuke searched Dilly's face for an answer. "I sure like that boy," he continued. "He had some great ideas to bring home. I would have enjoyed working with him a little longer. They were just the kind of strategies Rawl needs right now." "No," responded Dilly. "I assume he's still too embarrassed from quitting the Kusings to drop a line. You know Saab and the others from Rawl. They tease mercilessly. Even without him around, I've heard Sob make all kinds of jokes about him. I guess leaving a note in the middle of the night was a poor way to quit. He should have at least explained his case in person. Dodd stared at the door handle, prickling with goosebumps. There was something about Uke's voice or the conversation that triggered the morning images to return. He could hear people scheming, shrouded by darkness. Someone was listening, eavesdropping. The voices grew louder and louder. They discovered they weren't alone. They attacked. Beams collapsed. This time, Dodd saw more detail than he had before. Two hands used a saw to cut through support beams, which caused the collapse. The hands were gloveless, and the right hand had a familiar jagged scar. It was the same scar he had seen on the hand that had doomed Bamboo's wagon. Dodd froze as he watched Uke walk confidently down the hall. Dilly started rambling on about Uke's wife, Selusi, and how impossible she was to please, though Dodd didn't hear a word she said. This time the scene in his mind was too real to dismiss. He felt like the man with the scar was about to attack, and it appeared he was the Dread. Dodd determined something had to be done, but before he could say so much as a word to Dilly, Boot jogged up to them and broke in. "There you are," he said, exhausted. He was out of breath. He leaned on Dilly and Dodd, sandwiching himself between them. "I've been looking all over for you. I thought you were planning on attending Sir Long's practice." "We had a change of plans," said Dilly frankly, "which is fortunate for you. I know you'd rather speak with us here than be anywhere near Sir Long after last week." "Well, if I had known you were coming here, it might have been more fortunate. Sir Long sends an apology for the misunderstanding this morning. He said he's perfectly all right with accepting Dodd into the group if his skills with the sword are similar to the others. And by the way, that was a more pleasant message than the one he told me to bring to myself." "You went to practice?" choked Dilly with a laugh. "Sir Long expressly stated that he didn't want to see your face anywhere near his precious matches, or he'd teach you a lesson you'd never forget. Not to mention, you obviously showed up late. You have a horribly short memory or a thick skull, don't you?" "No, I just have an urgent delivery from Bamboo. He left for Highgate this morning and asked me to give this to Dodd before my regular routines. I tried to pass it along in the Great Hall, but someone played deaf." Boot handed Dodd a small wooden box. "So, what's inside?" asked Dodd. "I wouldn't know. Bamboo said it was for you and nobody else." "Didn't you peek?" "Maybe quickly," he admitted. "It was hardly long enough to consider it peeking. I closed it right up." Dilly looked at Boot suspiciously while Dodd examined the intricate designs on the outside of the container. "He's giving you three keys," confessed Boot. Dodd opened the box and found that Boot was right. A miniature scroll was tucked neatly underneath them. "I didn't know there was a message," said Boot. He struck like a snake and snatched the note from Dodd, even before it was out from under the keys. "Here, allow me," said Boot. He read aloud. "These three keys belonged to your grandfather. His room is still the way he left it. I've kept it locked since the assassination. Please have Boot or Dilly show you to it. I'm sure it may be hard for you to see his things, but they're yours now, as is the room. His clothes are about your size, though if it's hard for you to wear them, feel free to let Mercy know. She volunteered to help you acquire a wardrobe." "Mercy!" exploded Dilly, looking appalled. "Mercy doesn't know a thing about clothes. If you need help with clothes, let me help you. I insist." Boot glanced at Dilly and snapped. "Do you mind? Dodd wants to hear the rest of his personal letter." "And he probably wanted to read it alone," replied Dilly. "It's okay," said Dodd. "Read on." "Please, know that your grandfather was a dear friend to me. I miss him greatly. Also, I still plan on having that discussion I promised you. We can meet as soon as I return from Highgate. The large key is for the room. The other two were his, but I can't say what they open. I'm sure they're very important. Keep them safe. I'll see you soon. Your friend, Bamboo." Dodd looked around and made sure that nobody was near them in the hall. He especially checked to see that Uke had continued walking and was out of hearing range. "I need help from both of you," said Dodd quietly in a confidential voice. "Well, of course," responded Boot. He was loud and jovial. "You haven't the slightest idea where to find Pap's room, and this castle is monstrous enough to make a random search quite daunting. Don't worry, I've been there 100 times and can easily find it with my eyes closed." "Thank you, Boot, but could you keep your voice down?" said Dodd, getting agitated. "I have something else to discuss that's more urgent than seeing Pap's stuff." "You're kidding, right?" gasped Boot, peering at Dodd through slits. He wore a face full of wrinkles and disbelief. "Pap has the coolest things. I'm dying to look through his cabinets and cupboards. No, I'm serious, insisted Dodd. He shushed Boot before continuing. I don't want anyone else to hear us. I know that the Dread is going to attack, and I think it will be here, and soon. Dodd tried to look courageous, even though the blood had drained from his face in fear. He felt as though the mass murderer, who had poisoned his grandpa, was now targeting him. I think the Dread is already among us, announced Dodd. He's in disguise. Dilly rolled her eyes while Boots widened with excitement. Dodd had actually wanted to say that he thought the Dread was someone like Uke or Zerny. Nevertheless, after Dilly's lecture that morning, Dodd toned it down to suggesting he was near them. Great, whispered Boot excitedly. You can count on me. What do you know? Dilly pulled Boot's arm off her shoulder and shoved him. Boys, she said with disgust, you two can't focus on reality long enough to sit through a course on swordplay. It's always something. Not this time, said Boot in Dodd's defense. Oh, really? Answered Dilly, shaking her head. What about the time you accused Strahd of infiltrating Twistyard as a traitor? You said his purpose was to sabotage our game of Belurse. What became of it? Boot was embarrassed that Dilly had brought it up in front of Dodd. He squirmed uncomfortably and searched the air with his eyes for a good explanation. That was different, he finally blurted. You can't get mad at me for being suspicious when a new Belurse instructor had us spend our time focusing on throwing zolberries and cutting weeds, and with dull sticks at that. It appeared to be malicious. Dilly enjoyed the moment. She clearly thought it was fun to torture Boot. And don't forget he was close friends with Bly, added Boot, attempting to defend himself. Back then, any association with Bly drew concern. And what happened? Asked Dilly with a smile on her face. She knew the answer already, yet wanted him to have to explain how poor his judgment had been. Well, he turned out all right, admitted Boot reluctantly. Just all right, prodded Dilly. Wouldn't you say he turned out more than all right? The first 2 years may have been spent on rigorous training, but the last 6 years of winning the Golden SWAT have proven his training works. Besides, even if he's unconventional, nobody could dispute his greatness. And as for his relationship with Bly, it's not a bad thing anymore, is it? Dilly poked at Boot with her elbow and turned to look at Dodd before continuing. The charges against Bly as a war criminal and Soosh were all dismissed, and Commendus personally led that investigation. Bly is now one of the wealthiest entrepreneurs, and thanks to Strahd, he shares some of his money with Twistyard in support of our cause. Okay, you're right, confessed Boot, raising both hands in the air. Run me through with your sword and get it over with. I admit I was wrong. But this time we're not talking about my judgment. We're talking about Dodd's. And if you have a problem with his, you'll need to explain it to more than just me. Dodd saved Bamboo's wagon with his quick thinking. Dilly wasn't entirely convinced. However, Dodd and Boot were her friends, so she patched things up by using a half-apology mixed with heavy skepticism. As I was saying, Dodd finally continued, I feel the Dread is near. It's like I can see glimpses of what he's about to do or what he's recently done. You're psychic, blurted Boot gleefully. I knew it. The way you handled yourself on the wagon, I mean, it wasn't typical. Boot stopped Dilly in her tracks and spun her toward Dodd, using his powerful arms, and said, Take a look at him. We've got an extrasensory genius. This is the best thing that's happened to us, to the Cousings, to Greenhall. Do you know what this means? Dilly began to laugh. When Boot had taken his sweaty arm off Dodd's shoulder, he had jumbled Dodd's hair on one side of his head, coaxing it to stand on end, while the other side looked normal. It made Dodd appear less like any kind of a genius, and more like a confused bedhead kid. Boot jumped in and smoothed Dodd's hair, apologizing for his contribution of sweat, and hopped back once more. He wiggled his fingers in Dodd's direction and tried to recapture the moment he had attempted to present to Dilly, but it was pointless. Dilly continued to laugh. He's psychic, Dilly! He's psychic! Boot repeated the phrase, getting more and more excited each time he said it. Could you tap in on Sob's game plan? Asked Boot, rubbing his hands together. What? Said Dodd. Or Sir Lonk. Dilly, we could use him for you, too, said Boot, his eyes growing bigger by the second. Dodd could do his thing and come up with the right way to impress Sir Lonk. Maybe pull a few memories he hasn't shared with very many people. Oh, better yet, he could see the next time something unlucky was going to happen to Sir Lonk, and you could magically be the one to warn him. Think of it, Dilly. This is great. Dodd stared at Boot, not wanting to be the one to pop his bubble, but suddenly realizing he had to. Boot, said Dodd hesitantly, I wouldn't really call it being psychic. You wouldn't, said Boot. He studied Dodd's face with hopeful eyes. Then what would you call it? Dilly went quiet momentarily, controlling her laughter enough to hear Dodd's own description of his superpower. It's more like, well, being lucky. Dilly roared. She laughed so hard that tears streamed down her face. You've got, Dilly said haltingly, trying to speak in between her explosions of laughter. A scary weapon for a friend. So it's luck, said Boot, disappointed. Kinda, muttered Dodd, feeling embarrassed. Boot hopped in quickly and tried to make him feel better. I know, said Boot, faking a chuckle. We really had Dilly going, didn't we? He slid up next to Dodd, and together they began to walk down the hall again, with Dilly attempting to regain her composure, trailing behind. Okay, said Boot. Before we pulled that one on Dilly, you were saying something? Yeah, said Dodd. It's hard to explain. I've had a few weird dreamlike things where I've seen, well, I think it's the Dread, and he's hurting people here at Twistyard. Maybe they're nothing. No, said Boot. They could be right. Do you have any idea of where? I don't, admitted Dodd. This place is huge, and I've only glimpsed a tiny bit of it. I guess you could help me try to figure out the location based on details I remember. Sure, said Boot. Go ahead. The floor was made of stone, just like this one. That's the whole castle and half of the surrounding buildings, said Dilly, exasperated. She rejoined the boys to taunt them. And the walls were made of the same stone, added Dodd. I don't remember any fancy wooden trim or decorations, except a little on the support beams, maybe at an entrance. It also seems like the halls were more narrow than these, probably half the size, and the smell was really musty or something. You smell in your dreams, teased Dilly, mocking the effort. I'd say it's the storage chambers beneath the stable, said Boot, ignoring her. The last word caught Dodd's attention because it naturally connected the trouble to Zerny and Jib. I doubt it, responded Dilly, finally entering the conversation for real. What purpose would the Dread have under the stables? It's probably in the basement of Sword Tower. And how would you know what that basement looks like? Asked Boot. Bamboo has had it quarantined and guarded for over 15 years, since the tribal outfield came down. Dilly's face showed she had incriminated herself, though she looked more proud than sorry. Oh, I've seen it, she said smugly. I have a sword collection that occasionally needs new recruits. Bamboo thinks they are too dangerous to have about the castle in our care, so I keep mine under my bed, about 24. You never know when we might wish for a quick sword. Dilly, said Dodd in a surprised voice. I thought you kept all of the rules. I do, pronounced Dilly with confidence. I keep all of the rules that need keeping. That would explain the occasional clanking I've heard, said Boot, connecting the dots in his mind. I thought part of your nighttime ritual included hitting a metal bar, like the superstitious do for good luck, until Sonny assured me that it was the chatter of your squeaky bed frame. And I suppose she was at least partially right. It was your bed frame, telling the world of your contraband sword collection. The threesome made their way down the hall, continuing to assess the possible locations, all the while being cautious when around other people. In time, they discovered that there were 22 conceivable spots spread out around the complex, mostly the basements of various outbuildings. Dodd wanted to quickly walk through each of them. Boot was willing and even began to figure a logical order. Dilly, on the other hand, pretended to be disinterested. She said a lot about how pointless the effort was. That is, until after Dodd shared some of his other experiences, the ones that included flutters of a noose and the sabotaged riggings of Bamboo's wagon. Then she believed enough in his kind of luck to want to be an active part. As a matter of fact, she insisted that she should take the lead, considering a few of the halls were off limits and would be impossible to enter except at night with her expert abilities. In the end, Dilly calculated it would take at least a week to check the locations in their spare time. Dodd tried to convince her that the matter was urgent enough to warrant missing regular activities. However, Dilly concluded with an irrefutable response which tingled Dodd's ears with fright. If the Dread is among us, she said, then we must act normal. Any suspicious behavior would certainly lead to a swift and fatal meeting with him.